Police have had, and as the hunt for Mikhail enters its second night, his whereabouts remain a complete mystery.
Ed Miliband's promised to make the banking sector more competitive if he becomes Prime Minister. The Labour leader wants to force the biggest banks to sell off large numbers of branches, which would be split between two new companies. A memorial has been held for four US Air Force members who died in a helicopter crash in Norfolk last week. Many of their colleagues gathered for the service at their base, RAF Lakenheath. President Barack Obama has announced a ban on US eavesdropping on the leaders of close friends and allies. In a major speech, he's announced a series of reforms to the National Security Agency, triggered by revelations by whistleblower Edward Snowden. Sarah Tindall and her new royal baby are both doing great. Her rugby player husband Mike Tindall's tweeted, thanking people for their wishes and calling today's the best day of his life. David Cameron's among those sending their congratulations.
It's wonderful news and I'm absolutely delighted for the couple. I know them a little and I know they'll be absolutely devoted and delighted parents. So happy news all round.
And in showbiz, British actress Natasha McElhone is to star in the first stage adaptation of Fatal Attraction in London. She'll play the character made famous by Glenn Close in the film. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, it's Friday again. It's BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. It's a bit of a deep voice this week, a bit of a cold, but helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Bishopston Ward, Daniela Radici. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, as ever, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a massive dossier from public interest lawyers on British war crimes during the invasion and occupation of Iraq, which took 2 years to prepare, goes to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. It could mean long jail terms for senior British politicians and army chiefs, but hardly a whisper about it on the London news. If nothing else, this should wake us up to the extent to which our news is being censored. Also, intercepting your post to plant spyware and bugs on your nice new laptop and reading all your text messages without a warrant. Also, planting secret Wi-Fi data harvesters on computers that aren't actually connected to the internet. Yet more criminal excesses by the secret Stasi state. Plus, the 30th anniversary of the miners' strike, we hear from author of The Enemy Within, Seamus Milne, whose dad, Alastair, was the last really good Director General at the BBC. He explains how the Thatcher government had to resort to dirty tricks because Arthur Scargill and the miners nearly won a fair fight. Also, musician Roger Waters from Pink Floyd compares the Israeli government to Nazi Germany. Why does he say that? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 9, getting warmer. Cloudier on Saturday with showers and some gusty winds, but sunny on Sunday. Next week, highs about 11 Celsius, a mixture of sunshine and showers this week with some gusty winds. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of January, highs up a little, edging up to 10 Celsius, cloudy and windy, but hopefully rain-free. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Ashley... for Bishopston. That's Daniela Radici. Hi, Daniela, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Now, Daniela, just give us a bit of an introduction as to what got you into becoming a councillor, and also, why the Green Party?
Well, I became a councillor. I've been involved in as an environmental manager for a number of years, and also just naturally interested in politics, I suppose.
But what's an environmental manager?
I got involved. I worked for Network Rail, and I used to go around telling people to tidy up their oil bins and making sure Network Rail weren't killing too many furry animals on the side of the tracks when they do their engineering works.
So did you bankrupt them? Because I think
I did not. But I did actually get quite good at spotting badger sets because they're quite destructive. on the railway tracks. But so I got a bit frustrated really with the day-to-day people on the ground got the environmental messages, but the managers never did. And I just felt actually we need to get this sort of higher up in the political agenda. And I felt the only way we could get the environmental message up the political agenda and actually get the decision makers taking account of environmental issues was to get into politics.
Now, this, you've just mentioned the badgers. We can't pass that one over because we've just heard, haven't we, this week, £1,800 to kill every single badger that was culled in Gloucestershire. Yeah. This has been incredibly expensive. Yeah. Another estimate is around about £1,300 per badger. Now, this has been massively expensive. Also, we've heard from Owen Paterson, the Environment Secretary, this week, that he's apologising because he was overstating the number of cases of TB in cattle. So what has happened here, and what's your view as an environmentalist on what's happened?
Don't talk to me about Owen Paterson. Well, from everything he's said, he's ridiculously awful. But I think the badger issue is that the government's own chief scientist said this was a bad idea, because badgers are very territorial, and they, if you kill some of them, the other ones will move into their territory, and that's just not the way to deal with it. You need to think like a badger if you want to get badgers to move. You need to think, what will dissuade badgers from coming into a territory? And I think it just needs a bit more intelligence about the whole thing. And badgers aren't necessarily causing the TB. Who's moving cattle around the country? It's the farmers. It's the badgers are staying where they are in their own little territories and catching TB from the cows. So yeah, it's a crazy thing. I mean, Owen Paterson, it's almost unbelievable that he is the Environment Secretary, because he has expressed doubts about climate change. The other week he was saying that ancient forests could be moved, showing a complete disregard and lack of understanding of what an ancient forest actually is, that the whole point is that the soil is precious and the whole ecosystem is precious. So and he was also caught out today pretending that the government was spending more on flood prevention than it ever had, and it was shown that he hadn't.
Yeah, naughty boy. Also, of course, the report which led to the badger cull in the first place. Now, that would have cost, I mean, if you divide that up per badger, you're talking about nearly £5,000 per badger just to write the report to say that the badgers need culling. Something seems horribly wrong here. What would you be doing? I mean, if you were in Owen Paterson's shoes, Daniela, to do something about TB, are you convinced of the link between badgers and TB?
I acknowledge that badgers do have TB and cows have it, but I think you need to think maybe there is too high a badger population, because I acknowledge they do cause damage to railway embankments. I've seen what they do, and they're very good diggers. But you need to think like a badger, and you think, actually, maybe we should create some biological type of controls, you know, what eats badgers, or maybe you just make pheromone sort of traps to dissuade them from going where you don't want them to go. You just need to think a bit more intelligently and more like a sort of biologist and think about the ecosystems.
Okay, now tell us a little bit about the Green Party and how it works here in Bristol, because it's the fourth party. You started off with one Green councillor, now you've got, I believe it's four.
That's right. Here in Bristol, we're a party of four councillors out of 70. We think we do quite well in terms of punching above our weight. We've got Gus on the cabinet, who's in charge of neighbourhoods and environment and communities. So he's doing a lot of stuff on energy, renewable energy, parks, and on devolving power to neighbourhoods.
Yeah, but Gus Hoyt, have you seen the Bristolian, the little scandal sheet? It's our little Bristol's version of Private Eye, isn't it? They call him Gus Hoity-Toity. And the reason they do that is because he sometimes seems to go along with Mayor Ferguson's, you know, more draconian measures. Like, for example, evictions under the bedroom tax. A lot of people have been critical of Gus, saying, well, look, Gus, why have you gone along with this?
Yeah, it is a very difficult situation, I think, for all political parties in Bristol, in that we've all chosen to work, send somebody into the cabinet to work with the mayor. That means they do have to take a different line sometimes from what their party believe in. I know Gus, I mean, I heard him talking to the BBC today about this very issue, and he's like, you know, we are fundamentally opposed to the bedroom tax in policy. And the eviction situation is, as we understand it, that if you have a blanket no evictions policy, it's very, very difficult to find the people who can't be evicted from the bedroom tax. And eviction is always the very, very last resort at the end of a long line, and we've got a lot of safeguards in place to prevent people who really are getting into trouble from the bedroom tax to pick them up at an early stage.
I mean,
is what the council
when it costs something like £4,000, maybe a little less, a little more to evict someone. How does that make sense when you're only talking about a few pounds a week that they're not managing to pay because of the tax?
Exactly. I think that's precisely the point, that the council would never really actually want to evict anyone. So,
Okay, let's also, because, I mean, your ward, Bishopston, is a bit of a hot place to be at the moment. What with the projected building of the supermarket up there. Just tell us what is proposed and where.
Yeah, well, I'm involved in the campaign group Trash, as I'm sure you're aware, and we are campaigning against the new supermarket on the Memorial Stadium that's been given planning permission by the Bristol City Council. There's a proposal for a new Sainsbury's that will be of the dimensions bigger than Tesco Eastville. So this isn't a small local supermarket. This is a massive shed selling all the range of goods.
Now, for people that don't know where the Memorial Stadium is, if you're going up Gloucester Road, where it splits off into Filton Avenue, it's a little bit off from the side of the road up there, isn't it?
So we have two major concerns about this. One is, I mean, there's plenty of choice of supermarkets in the area if you do want to shop in a supermarket. The council did an independent retail survey and showed that about 17 million a year would be lost from Gloucester Road traders as a result of this. This could actually eventually cause the closing down of local shops and actually degrade our whole high street, which has been described as the best high street in the country and the jewel of Britain's high street. So it's not a minor thing to put high street. The government's own national planning policy framework is supposed to prevent these kind of supermarkets being built and undermining local high streets. So that's one issue. The other issue is the traffic congestion pollution. If you can imagine an air pollution, I mean, Gloucester Road is already an air quality management area, which means it's worse for pollution than the surrounding, than it should be according to EU level. So people are getting, you know, poisoned by the air, the traffic pollution around there. And it's a major junction for the city. It's through route. We've got the new Southmead Hospital. We've got huge development happening at Filton. So there's going to be even more traffic pressures on that junction. The council planning transport officers, when they came before the planning committee, actually said that some of the junctions after the building supermarket would be at 110% capacity. And they kind of said, well, it's all right because traffic will go elsewhere.
Now, I can remember this argument used in the run-up, this is probably 10 years ago, to the building of IKEA on the M32, or just off the M32, and people were saying, well, you can't build it there because it's going to... And, of course, now we know that you've got these great tailbacks, especially on a Saturday, for example, queues to get into IKEA and Tesco's at Eastville going right back onto the M32. So this is actually quite dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that is the reality, is that it will cause huge traffic congestion and it will cause more rat running on local residential roads as well. So it will have knock-on effects across the city. I mean, it's the way the geography of the city is. We don't have a lot of choice of routes where to go when people are commuting in and out.
Well, the Bristol Post has been saying that the Rovers Stadium, this new one, could be the key to extending a rail line, which I would imagine as a Green you'd like to see. Transport ministers are likely to look more favourably on proposals to reopen the Henbury Loop line if Bristol Rovers' new stadium is built. The admission was made by Transport Minister Stephen Hammond in response to a parliamentary question by Bristol North West MP Charlotte Leslie. What's Charlotte's position on all this?
Charlotte has been quite recently, she was never didn't express an opinion early on in the campaign either way, but recently she's been very vociferously campaigning in favour of the Sainsbury's development. She's accused our campaign group of being malicious, which I assure you is the last thing that we are, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, according to the BBC, you're anti-stadium.
Well, that was a misquote by them in an article online only this week.
That's right, it's on the BBC website. Yes. That's a bit naughty. Well, tell us how that happened then.
Well, I was asked by a journalist to comment for their article. They were doing a comparison of Cardiff and Bristol, as these journalists like to do, which I think is wrong anyway, because we're not in competition, they're a different city. Saying, oh, you know, Bristol never gets anything built, and Cardiff has. And I just said, I'm not anti-stadium. I want Bristol Rovers to have a new stadium, but actually I'm just anti-supermarket. It's the wrong place for a new supermarket. And they wrote in their article something along the lines of, anti-stadium campaigner says this, that and the other. So I will be putting a complaint
Good luck on getting that corrected anyway. But I mean, what about this issue of opening the rail line? Because surely that's something that the Greens should be looking quite positively on.
Yeah, of course. We're very much in favour of the Henbury Loop, the station at Ashley Down and a new station at Horfield. And that is all that part of a agreed package of measures. But obviously it's not been very quick to be implemented. And I don't I can't actually see how the Henbury Loop would influence, because there's already a station at Filton Abbey Wood, which is the closest station to the proposed stadium. So I don't quite see the connection.
Well, it's written this like we've got a sneak leak from Westminster here, but I'm not quite sure.
I know Charlotte Leslie is also passionate about the Henbury Loop, and you know, on that one we'd both agree.
Now, what about the money involved in this? Because of course there is a lot of, I mean, you know, if they get the build this new stadium, what they've done essentially is buy a piece of land at a very cheap price, because it's you know, it's not building land, and then get their planning permission for it. So what they're doing is they're actually making quite a lot of money, the club itself, on the planning deal, on the planning gain that they're getting from the site. So, I mean, can you see it from the club's point of view, is that they may not survive unless this deal goes through?
I know they want their £39 million. I don't, £39 million to build a new stadium, but they don't. Well, they want a new stadium, but they have a stadium at the moment, and they have extant permissions to improve it if they wanted to on that very site. The council has given them permission to reorganise, rebuild that stadium itself.
But that probably won't give them enough money. If they can build a new stadium on some cheap land, in other words, and then sell the old piece of land at a high price, then they're making actually a lot of money on the planning gain. The planning gain being the extra value they get from getting planning permission on the new site.
Yeah, and they could get money from selling it for housing, for instance, because Bristol, as you know, has got 14,000 people on the housing waiting list. We desperately need more houses. We don't need more supermarkets.
But a lot of the locals quite like the idea of having a Sainsbury's though, Daniela.
Some people do, yeah, but there's also going to be a new Asda, I think, and Filton as well as the existing Sainsbury's, there's also plans for one at Gainsborough Square, so there's not a shortage of plans for new supermarkets in the area.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about all the sort of politics behind this? Because it seems to be that both Bristol City and Rovers seems to be more about trying to manage their debts than it does about actually playing football.
Well, that's true of virtually all football clubs, even more successful ones than City and Rovers, like Man United, for example. What's happened in football, as in many other things, is you've got basically corporate raiders moving in, taking out loans to buy out football clubs, and then you've got Manchester United, probably the most successful football club in the world in financial terms, but they're still struggling because they've got to pay all the debts back that have been run up by the guys taking them over, whose name now escapes me. In Barcelona Football Club is in fact a social enterprise owned by the people of Barcelona, and it couldn't be bought out by some Russian oligarch.
So how does that work then? Everybody that's a fan is also a part owner, they get a share.
Yes, and of course some people have more shares than others, but being a social enterprise, I believe you know, when they have votes and things, it's one person, one vote. It's not a question of how many shares you've got. And in other words, that embeds Barcelona Football Club absolutely in the community, and of course it's linked with ideas about Catalan nationalism and so on. And you know, what we've allowed to happen in Britain, and the same's happened in rugby league, is that, you know, wealthy people have borrowed money for their hobby and then saddled the clubs with the debts, which of course led to Rangers, in, you know, the historic club in Scotland, collapsing completely. And of course it's just more of the silly free market philosophy that we've seen in other industries.
Okay, now Martin, your leader, leader of Her Majesty's Opposition, Ed Miliband, big speech today, saying that bank branches need to be sold off to tackle the broken banking market. He says that an industry that's supposed to be a service, banking, has been pretty poor.
Well, I mean, I'm glad he said something about banks, but I'd rather he'd said something about splitting off the casino banks from the retail banks. This is really about poor service by the retail banks and, you know, the fact that they rip off their customers and so on. But the real problem with the banking system is that the casino banks are bust and they're going to pull down the whole world economy. So this, in a way, is... Nobody is allowed in the mainstream to talk the honest truth about the mess that the financial sector is in.
I noticed,
so this is a hint. He's hinting that he's going to do something.
I noticed,
and he's being accused of all sorts by the bankers themselves.
Look,
but this is pretty tame stuff, really.
I noticed also yesterday that Mark Carney got his shot into Miliband before he'd even made his speech.
Yeah.
He was saying that he didn't think the Labour policy was going to work before the speech was even given today.
Well, that was the one about bonuses. He was saying you shouldn't think... I've just read an interesting book about bonuses by a guy called Andrew Smithers, who's... it's called The Road to Recovery, And it's very, very detailed. And he's saying the fundamental problem with our economy is the bonus culture at the top, which has led to enormous overpayments to people at the top, and also people at the top taking a totally short-term attitude and milking whatever they're doing for short-term profits, because their salary, they're not even paid a salary anymore. It's linked to profits, so they buy their own shares, for example, to push the share price up, which then brings their remuneration up. So if you look, and he's got loads of stats in the book and loads of graphs, and it's quite, and he said it's not just that this is unfair they've managed to just line their own pockets, it also creates a situation where they would rather make money now than invest in the future. And the level of investment in Britain, as Michael Meacher pointed out at Prime Minister's Questions a few weeks ago, is lower than in Mali, and that is because the managers are not investing in anything. They want to just make money now and walk away. And that, of course, is exactly what we were talking about in relation to football clubs, but it runs across the board.
Just remind us of that book again.
It's called Andrew Smithers, and it's called The Road to Recovery. It was published last year. So it's quite a mainstream book in one way, but he's actually critiquing. He says the fundamental problem that we're facing is that the managers across industry, particularly particularly the financial services industry, particularly in the US, particularly in Britain, their incentives have changed, so they're not thinking about the long term, and nobody thinks about the long term anymore. Their salary remuneration has become linked to the share values of the companies that they're managing. In the past, in the 60s, for example, the managers would often take a long term view of the future of the company, because they're probably more interested in having a bigger company, because the bigger your company is, the bigger your salary is going to be. Now their salaries are directly linked to the profitability of the companies, which was supposed to make them more responsive to shareholder value. But what it means in effect is that they rob everybody in the end in order to try and make short-term profits, which bump up their bonuses.
Yeah, I think there's also, I read an interesting statistic in a book about actually how long-lived most companies are. And if you look over the past 100 years ago, there are actually very, very few companies that were operating 100 years ago that are still in operation today, because they have this kind of, they seem to burn out and don't have a very long-term
future.
Not
true in Japan, though.
Yeah.
Different. They've got different problems.
Talking about things like dividends and shares and this kind of thing, we did mention last week, didn't we, this crazy idea. It seems crazy, doesn't it, that if you've got enough money in your savings, you can just invest in one of the energy companies. I was reliably informed yesterday, not Empower, because their share price isn't doing too well, but one of the other ones. If you invest that around about £20,000, if you've got a 2 or 3 bedroom house in one of those energy companies, you won't be paying any electricity bills. That £20,000 will be the dividends you get from it, will be paying your electricity bill for you, and then after 10 years or whatever, when you want to cash your £20,000 back in, it's gone up at quite a large amount of money. You've actually made quite a lot of money on that investment. So anybody that's investing £20,000 or more in one of these big energy companies never has to pay anything for fuel again. So who is actually paying for fuel? It's the poorer end of people that don't have that £20,000.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, those who have, what quantitative easing has done is it's protected the assets of the asset-owning classes, who are a minority of the population. And some, of course, have got a lot more than others. But quantitative easing protects their assets. And, of course, what people are into, they're not even interested in the dividends, really. It's the value of the shares rising in value. Shares rising in value is actually more important than the dividend payout.
Well, it's both. What I'm saying is that dividend payment every year is paying all your energy bills for you, all your gas and electricity is paid by the dividend. And then at the end of your, however long you invest it, 4, 5, 10 years or whatever, you get a big lump sum back with inflation plus quite a lot.
I'll just make one point.
I don't want to encourage people to do this. Seems perverse.
What should have happened if you were pursuing a free market policy was when Lehman Brothers went bust, when Northern Rock went bust, you let them go bust, and you follow and just let the consequences flow through. And the von Mises Institute and some of the more solid free market thinkers have argued that all along. Now, once you've decided not that you are going to bail them out and they're not going to go bust, then what you're doing is making a political decision to keep the wealthy classes in the style to which they've become accustomed. It's got nothing to do with the free market at all. The free market ended in 2008, no matter what George Osborne says later on this programme. And the point is that most people haven't realised that free market capitalism is over. and that's certainly not hearing that in the mainstream discussion.
It's also about saying the risky behaviour is okay because we'll bail you out. You can do what you like.
It makes them worse.
You can lose all that money you like, but we'll always come back and bail you out and save your bacon.
Which is why we've got such an enormous bubble. Building.
Well, this is what apparently was being said about the big five banks. I was listening to BBC Five Live earlier on, HSBC, Barclays, RBS, Santander and Lloyds, that these big banks can borrow money at amazingly good rates because they are too big to fail. The smaller banks, people can't get into the market. And this is what Ed Miliband's saying, is he wants smaller banks to be able to get into the market. But marketing, what you're saying is that actually... That's not good enough. That's a limited hangout. He needs to be doing more than that.
Yes, he does. And all he's talking about there is retail banking, which there have been some abuses in retail banking, like the payment protection insurance scam and so on. But the real problem is the investment banking, which is absolutely, it's like a black hole.
I mean, that was widely recognised back after the crash. Everyone said, oh yeah, we've got to do something about casino banking. And they had all those reports and reviews, and that was the recommended outcome, was that they separated them out. But
which always used to be the case.
Something's happened, slipped along the way, and everyone's forgotten though.
Well, what's happened is they've used the bailout money to lobby behind the scenes for nothing to happen. So we've paid for these people to lobby against the regulations that we ought to be imposing on them. And if people can't, I mean, the very good bit in the Smithers book is that if people can't see what's wrong with that, then they need to have a word with themselves.
Before we go to Westminster for Prime Minister's questions, a bit of news from the Bristol Post that the funding plan has been agreed for Bristol's £91 million arena. Now, this is something that's been being talked about, gosh, is it 20 years now? Oh, we've got to have this arena. First of all, Daniela, do you think we need an arena? And also, is this £91 million well spent?
I think an arena is a good idea. I mean, we are one of the largest cities that doesn't have a large venue. I mean, it's not my idea of a night to go to a big venue like that to hear
a
band.
What about football? Can you not use a football stadium for something like that?
Well, I think arena is that. And the thing about this arena is that it's in the right place because it's by the railway station, so people will be able to get to it from all over the city and come by train and come in by bus. So I think that's a really good
reason.
I mean, you'll be able to have a lot more different events there. It's going to be used for all sorts of community
will
events.
Will people be able to afford to go?
I hope so. Given that the city's agreed to pay borrow 90 million to pay for it.
Well, the city council, according to the Post, the city councillors have committed £38 million of the £91 million needed for the 12,000 seat stadium near Temple Meads. £53 million hole in the project's budget is expected to be filled by capital borrowed against money from Bristol's city deal in agreement with government. Tell us about this city deal. I think I remember a couple of years ago Nick Clegg coming down to Bristol to sign it, Daniela.
Yes, the city deal is a kind of agreement between government and the council, and it's actually to do with the local economic partnership, the West of England local economic partnership, about the Kale government devolving a little bit of business rates back to the council in particular parts, designated areas. So there's an area around Temple Meads which includes... which is where when businesses start growing there, to encourage businesses to go there, the council will be able to keep the growth in business rates from those businesses. They won't have to give it to the government. So it's all about saying that if you grow businesses in a particular place, you can keep the money for yourselves to do what you want. But obviously a lot of that money will have to be spent in offsetting the costs of growth, because you've got growth, you'll have more traffic, more people, more population. So, and those people will need amenities and services. So it's meant to supposedly balance out. But if we do get more business rates, we'll be able to have more of an income as a city to pay back our borrowing.
Yes, I mean, this is the idea is great, but Bristol's economic vision, this is an article on Bristol 24/7, which is an independent website, news website, run by Chris Brown, who used to work at the Evening Post. He says economic vision is blind to a closing gap between Bristol's rich and poor. Until we address the real problems of equality of opportunity, the city will never realise its true economic and social potential. That's Tessa Coombs writing. Economic prosperity and quality of life, that's what the latest plan from the West of England Local Enterprise Partnership is all about. It's pitched as a strategic economic plan to deliver on jobs and growth to the year 2030. to maintain and enhance the excellent quality of life we have in this area already, and to reinforce our strengths by supporting growth in key sectors. All sounds great. What's not to like about that? But sadly, she says, it lacks any real acknowledgement of the very real inequalities that exist in the city. The danger is the plan as it currently stands will only serve to increase the disparities between the rich and the poor.
Yep, I agree largely with what she said. And it's, I really like all listeners to go out, go to the West of England website, and you can comment on that economic strategy and have your say, because they are collecting everyone's comments and seeing what they have to say about it. And it's a really important thing to do, because the government is planning to give large chunks of money to the LEP to spend on economic regeneration in the area. And this could be anywhere, well, sort of starting probably around £40 million. Year, so it's a large chunk of money that's going to be spent in this area, and we need to have our say. We've been talking about a member of a new organisation called the Women's Commission, and we were talking about that this morning, because it's actually it's sort of chosen particular sectors where growth should be, but they actually happen to be all male dominated sectors, and there's very little talk of how you're going to get women into those sectors. The issue of childcare is absolutely important, or caring responsibilities for people. If you can help with childcare and caring responsibilities, you can help thousands of people become much more economically active, and that's proved in reports from the Institute of Public Policy Research. There's nothing about that. The governance of the LEP also needs looking at in quite a lot of detail. It's got the four leaders of the councils, Bristol and the other ex-Avon area. It's also got a whole load of businessmen on it. And we're not really quite sure how they got appointed to that board. They just happen to be on it. And I don't see any mechanism for electing.
Well, this doesn't sound very democratic, does it? And also, I know that because of the way it's set up, the public aren't allowed any access to the decisions they made. Now, one of the things that bothered me about this wonderful, so-called wonderful city deal that Nick Clegg signed was that the management of all the public land in Bristol was being handed over to the local enterprise partnership, to a subgroup of it called the Public Property Board. Now, I would have thought that land, things like parks, and also Bristol, I mean, of all of the local authorities in the country, apparently owns more land as a proportion of its area than any other local authority. Now, this is all now apparently being managed by the West of England Partnership, which is unelected and is totally untransparent. Well, they'll release to you what they want to, but they won't tell you anything else. So sounds to me like a form of privatisation.
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, the property board is a distinct Bristol innovation, not part of the LEP. So even though it might be people from LEP on it, it only applies to the Bristol area. And it was, as you say, it's to do with all public land, so Ministry of Defence land, health land, any other land, to bring it together to try and maximise its income. And I think Bristol local authority has in a certain sense been prudent in the past and hung on to land, because it is actually a valuable asset for the people of the city. And it really needs to, we need to keep an eye on what's going on there to make sure it's we know where it's going and what's being done with it.
Who is on this public property board, do you know?
Apart from George Ferguson, I do not know.
Okay. Martin, what about this? Because this is a lot of public assets here involved in this local enterprise partnership. All sounds great. We're having a critique there saying, well, they're just completely ignoring poor people. And also, it's undemocratic, and we don't know how people are appointed to it. They just seem to magically appear on the board.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, public property, I was involved in, when I was working for the council, in what they called asset transfer, or discussions around asset transfer. And the idea was that, you know, a community group or a group or a non-statutory group could take over a public asset and run it, and they would be given it, and you would offset that by the benefits that they would bring to the community. So the idea is that you'd develop some technique for cost-benefit analysis of how much this would benefit the public, and therefore this asset could be handed over. And there was an awful lot of talk about this in social enterprise circles a few years ago, but it would run up against the fundamental problem, which the accountants used to say is, look, public assets cannot just be given to private individuals, because they just can't. And this idea that the
public... Well, to be fair, they're not giving it to the public property board or the local enterprise board. They're saying you can manage it, because we think business people can manage it better than the local authority.
This idea of a partnership between business and local authorities, I'll just put a big question mark over it. Because ultimately, business is business, and local authorities have a different mandate than to just boost employment, for example, or create businesses. I'm not saying that we're opposed to creating businesses, but the idea that we're all in favour of creating businesses and this is a good idea, perhaps we're not. We need to, the public interest is not necessarily benefited by any particular individual private development.
Well, it depends if that business is paying a living wage, doesn't it?
Of course, and I'd just like to add to that the LEP is actually not a constituted body in any way. It doesn't have any legislation leading to its pros. I don't know what kind of organisation it is. So there's no statutory legislation saying this LEP should be this, this, and this. This is an idea by dreamed up in Whitehall. So do we want someone, businesses, to hand over public money to do economic growth with, as Martin says?
Well, they're on the internet. They're on bristol.gov.uk website. It's called the Bristol Property Board. It won't tell you who's... It says the mayor and various other people. It's basically saying... I'll just read this bit out about who's involved. It says, representative from the Homes and Communities Agency, Government Property Unit, Bristol City Council, and two representatives from the business community. But it doesn't actually say who they are.
I think it might be time for a Freedom of Information request.
How strange. Anyway, off to Westminster now. And Prime Minister's questions, Ed and Dave, this week, locked horns over housing.
There are sites... Mr. Speaker, there are sites all over the country with planning permission, with the capacity for 250,000 houses where nothing is happening. Some of them being hoarded by developers. I'm in favour of giving powers to say to developers that hold land without building on it, use it or lose it. The Prime Minister said the policy was nuts. Does he still believe that?
We've just had a demonstration of the grasp of maths that was involved at the Treasury. No wonder we had banks collapsing and all the rest of it with that. What I would say to the Honourable Gentleman is that house building is picking up. We're seeing a big increase in housing starts, a big increase in housing completions. Why I think his policy, as he kindly put it, nuts, is this reason, is that if you say to developers and companies, we're going to confiscate land unless you build, they will not go ahead with the building in the first place. His approach is to put a freeze on the whole of development rather than get Britain building, which is what we need to happen.
Well, use it or lose it, Martin, over these people who've got planning permission, ready to build houses, but they're not actually building. In fact, less building since than any time since 1925.
Yeah, and I think another fundamental problem is you either try and juice up the private property market, which is what the government's trying to do, particularly in marginal constituencies, or you have a social housing building programme. Because if you do have a big social housing building programme, that will, if it's an effective programme, stabilise, if not reduce, the value of private homes. So we're actually at a turning point here now. I think that what's going to happen is that the government are going to go for an entirely private sector solution with subsidy, of course, because when David Cameron went to meet the young woman who'd managed to buy her house under Help to Buy, it turned out that she was in fact an estate agent and she drove a big car, and in actual fact she is going to get a subsidy to buy a better house for herself. That's called looking after your own, but it's nothing to do with the free market. Nothing at all.
Daniela, what were your thoughts about that exchange, about the rate of building houses? Because Miliband's pointing out there, he made a little error in that he said, is it 250,000 or is it 250,000?
It's the same.
He tried to correct himself, but actually it was all the same. But what are your thoughts about his point, the actual point he's making, which is we've got more than ever. House builders have got the planning permission, but they're not building.
Yeah, I think he's actually quite right on this point that, if you've got planning permission, you should get on and do it, or, give it to somebody else who can, I think.
Well, the trouble is that, the house builders obviously think, well, they may not be able to sell the houses. They're only going to build as many as they can sell. So we're a bit ahead of the game, but, surely that's just a business decision from their point of view.
Well, I think, I don't know about a lot about the rest of the country, but I know in Bristol we've definitely got a huge shortage of housing. So, as Martin says, you can... Or maybe you should just say, well, we'll transfer them back to the private sector, public sector, if you haven't built your houses. Let's have that land back.
OK, on to fracking now. And it was Tessa Munt that brought this up in the Commons.
Tessa Munt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Would the Prime Minister speak to his colleagues across government about the funding resulting from incentives for fracking being passed directly to parishes so that those communities who feel the impact of fracking are those who actually choose how that money is spent, rather than having to compete with district and county councils' other priorities.
Tessa Munt's a Liberal Democrat.
That's an important point. I mean, what we've set out is the overall level of financial support, so £100,000 when a well is dug, up to £10 million, theoretically, because of the 1% of revenue that will be paid, and then this absolutely vital point about 100% retention of business rates, which could have a very significant effect for local government finance. Now, the point she makes is, how do you divide that up between parishes, districts and counties, and also do you look at individual payments to individual households who might be inconvenienced? I think we should look at very local options and making sure that parishes and individual people will benefit. And I think it's something that colleagues will want to discuss and think about, so we can really get this right and help this industry to take off.
Well, he was obviously well behind the industry, isn't he? He wants it to take off. But the I newspaper this week on Tuesday had the headline, "Fracking bribes for all. Councils can keep more tax revenue if they let energy giants drill for shale gas. And oil and gas licences for 40% of Britain to go on sale this summer in an energy auction. Cameron tells his critics to get on board because shale gas could bring 74,000 jobs to Britain."
Yeah, well, I don't know quite where to start with. This is the shale gas in principle. There's the sort of bribery of local councils issue as well. I mean, I also heard Caroline Lucas, the Green MP, getting involved in this, because obviously we need our fossil fuel reserves to stay in the ground. In America, they've got cheaper fuel because they've got gas, but their fossil fuel use hasn't gone down because they're exporting coal.
But have you seen the price of energy these days?
Yeah, it's really high.
Well, now is the time to get it out, surely.
Yes, but we don't want to have fossil fuels because we're going to cause climate change and have massive knock-on effects for us in the future.
Okay, how about nuclear?
Nuclear is a interesting one too. I mean, the Green Party's policy is to oppose nuclear on the grounds of safety and that it's also long-term unsustainable. I mean, we think that actually renewable energy could be given a lot more subsidy. Why don't we get 100% of business rates back for people who have wind farms on their backyards? I mean, that policy could be used for those areas much more effectively. We also need, the best thing to do is actually to use less energy. We saw the government actually retreating on all its energy efficiency measures in December. It's downgraded the very scheme that was meant to actually make it easier for people to have lower fuel bills by insulating their homes.
Martin, we've also heard this week the French energy company Total has taken a 40% stake in shale gas exploration licences. Ultimately, though, are these bribes? Cameron, surely, is just trying to get this industry moving.
Yeah, but I mean, why should you have a policy of encouraging any particular industry? If you're following a free market policy, then if the frackers can manage to make it pay, they can make it pay. And if they can't make it pay, they can't make it pay.
But isn't the problem that there are local people who are being NIMBY, stick in the muds, that don't want the fracking going on near them?
Well, I think there's a case for not doing fracking at all, because it's not at all. There's evidence in the US particularly that it's poisoning water supplies and so on. I would just reiterate what Daniela said, which is that the real way to deal with all of these problems is to actually become more energy efficient, and we should be subsidising the creation of energy efficiency across the board, and then we would find that we had much less of a problem deciding where we're going to get more energy from. We shouldn't be beyond the wit of the kind of technology we have now and the kind of people we have now. We could presumably reduce our energy footprint massively if we were prepared to make the effort.
Well, just heard from The Guardian, in the last 5 minutes, in fact, Daniela, that an email has revealed that the British government has helped the shale gas industry manage the opposition to fracking. Government officials accused of cheerleading for fracking by sharing lines to take and meeting for post-dinner drinks with the fracking industry. Shale gas industry executives and government officials collaborated in private to manage Britain's public hostility to fracking. Emails released under Freedom of Information rules have revealed today.
Yeah, I that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, that's obvious that they love minerals extraction. It's something that seems to appeal to macho men who don't actually get and understand the issue of climate change. I just also like to say that, you know, we've also heard stuff in the news about Norway, that they've actually, you know, talking about giving all this money away if it did have to happen, it surely needs to go into a national pot to create some investment for the future. Norway have done massively well by putting all their North Sea money into a fund, and their economy is nice and solid. That they've got a good lump sum of money to keep them all going. If we do have to have fracking, which this government seems determined to do, surely there's better and more sustainable things to do with the money.
No, I read out a quote from a book last week which explained that fracking and shale gas was being looked at by the Nazis in the closing stages of the Second World War as a last-ditch attempt to try and get some energy. Also, these emails I've just mentioned from the Guardian's just leaked, sent throughout 2013. In fact, no, it wasn't a leak. It's a Freedom of Information request sent throughout 2013 are often chatty with summer holidays discussed, and in one case the Department of Energy and Climate Change apologises to the UK Onshore Operators Group. Sorry to raise your blood pressure on this subject again, they say, no expletives please, following a discussion of contentious policy points in another email. The UK OOG Chief Executive Ken Cronin tells Duarte Figueira, head of the Government's Office of Unconventional Gas and Oil, says, thanks for a productive meeting, it's like being set homework.
Well, I mean, we're seeing once again the revolving door between government and big business. If that was happening with wind farms, can you imagine what Tory backbenchers would be going nuts at
the Daily
wind
Mail
farm operators
of
getting the government to push their stuff down our throat and all the rest of it. Isn't it interesting that, as you mentioned, Tony, the treatment of wind farms and the treatment of fracking? But can you imagine, as I say, the wind farm operators, you know, if emails were leaked that they were getting the government to push their stuff, they'd go nuts.
Well, one of the things Cameron was saying there was that, you know, compensation for everybody that's affected. Well, does that include people who have this methane gas coming out through their water supply that is explosive? Does that include compensation for earthquakes that cause cracks to go through their houses? This kind of thing, because these are very closely associated now with fracking. It's very well known that in actually does cause houses to subside.
Well, just think of the opportunity costs. If these business rates are given to local NIMBYs to keep them quiet, that is money that could have been used for something else, like invading Iraq or paying for schools and hospitals. There is no free lunch. If these people get a free lunch, somebody else has to have something taken off them. And of course, as we saw with the housing issue, those that have are to be given, and those that have not, the little that they have is to be taken away. Basically, Tories aren't against subsidies, they're just against subsidies for poor people.
But there is definitely a problem with energy, and we're going to hear about a bit more about that now from the House of Commons. This particular MP is Chris Evans, who explains a lot of people, a lot of his constituents just simply cannot afford to keep their heating on.
Chris Evans, constituent.
Labour.
They can't afford food, can't afford to keep warm in winter, and can't afford to put petrol in the car to go to work, or because their wages are not going far enough. Will the Prime Minister finally accept the cost of living is stretching families in this line and constituencies like mine to breaking point?
Yeah.
I totally accept that we are still recovering from the Great Recession that took £3,000 out of a typical family's income. But what we're seeing now is more people in work, including in Wales. We're seeing actually real wages now starting to rise. And I think we can be confident, yes, it's difficult, yes, it's still hard work, but our economy is growing and we want that to be a recovery for everyone in our country.
What do you think about that, Daniela? Because we do need, don't we? We need to keep the energy on. The Greens seem to be saying as well, a little bit of wind power, it's just not going to be good enough.
Well, I think the point that I made earlier about insulation is key. Actually, we need to have actually energy efficient homes, because you know, we can build houses now that don't actually need any heating at all. Passive houses are a proven technology, but we see the house builders actually say we can't afford to build those sort of houses. But actually, the cost must be looked at in a whole life cost, in the fact that the people who are going to be living in those houses are paying the cost of a low energy efficient house for generations to come.
No, I remember reading a few years ago about house builders being lobbied by book publishers saying, well, please will you build bookshelves into your nice new houses so that people will buy books to put in those bookshelves. And I wonder, you know, whether there is a link between the energy companies and these volume house builders, where they're saying, we want you to build a house which is actually going to use maybe double the energy. People are going to have to pay us twice as much for their energy than they otherwise would.
Well, they're also scrimping on things like flooding defences. George Monbiot wrote an article about that this week, and he's saying that they've been told that they must build houses where the runoff is planned for. But of course, that all costs money. And we're relying on the private sector to build these houses. Even Ed Miliband is relying on the private sector to build these houses. Poor people cannot access private sector housing, and we've got the people who need housing are the poor, not the wealthy. And in actual fact, what we need to do is what Conservative governments did in the 1950s, build social housing.
I've got news for you,
Martin. It's a no-brainer.
I've got news for you, Martin, because the poor can't access social housing either.
No, like, and we've now got a situation where people on benefits are going to be evicted from private rented accommodation because of the benefit, because of the benefits changes. Now, where are those people going to end up? They ought to end up on David Cameron's front lawn.
I sat on a planning committee earlier in the last year where it was a site owned by the Homes and Communities Agency who'd brought forward the argument that the Homes and Communities Agency could not afford to build any affordable homes.
Why is that?
They just said that it wasn't economically viable.
Because I heard something about this where apparently with the problems with the Ministry of Defence budget, quite a lot of money had to be shifted from Homes and Communities agencies into the Ministry of Defence to build this aircraft carrier. So there wasn't enough money to build social housing. Oh dear, what a mess. Martin, what can be done about this? How can we actually give people? Because, I mean, society is not civilised if we're not actually building houses for people to live in. What seems to be happening is housing is not being treated as a basic need, human need, which it is. It's being treated as some kind of market which needs to be buoyed up in order to help the rest of the economy go.
It's speaking in the terms of the economy, the housing market in Britain and the property market is a millstone around our manufacturing industry's neck.
Why is that?
Because every time the economy starts to pick up, house prices in the southeast of England start to race ahead, and then eventually you have to raise interest rates to stop that from happening. But by at that stage, people who are trying to manufacture stuff and export it from north of the Wash in Britain find that the interest rates go up just as they're getting going. So in other European countries like Germany, you don't have massive property bubbles in housing because there's a massive rented sector, and even quite wealthy people will rent. They've got rent controls. We should be building social housing, but also, of course, we should simply be buying up empty houses and empty properties and turning those into social housing. I mean, what a Labour government should be promising is if you vote for us, we are going to grasp this nettle. Now, they're tiptoeing around all of this because, of course, they are being leaned on now as a potential new government. They're being leaned on now by the powers that be, the people in the city and so on, to say, you know, basically, you've got to lower what you're going to promise people. Now, I think Miliband sometimes rebels against that and sometimes doesn't. I understand his position. It's not easy because the media are against you, and if you come out with very radical policies, you'll be accused of being a nutcase. But frankly, a crisis like the one we've had now in the last 5 years is the opportunity to say, right, we are going to house everybody in this country adequately.
Is that feasible, Daniela?
Yeah, of course it's feasible. I mean, we can build houses. We know how to build them. There's public money available. But city, we know the government and the council can borrow money at a low rate because it's public.
But I mean, there is a knock-on effect, isn't there? If house prices do become depressed, if the need is fulfilled, house prices will start going down.
But you want house prices to stabilise.
Yeah.
That's what you want in the long run. You want house prices to be stable. People shouldn't be buying a house thinking, this is an investment for the future. It's a place to live. And if you've got any spare cash, well, think of a business idea.
Okay,
build a conservatory.
We do have coming up in May European elections this year, and so it was interesting to hear the UKIP boss Nigel Farage this week in the European Parliament in his usual condemnatory style. Let's have a listen to him now.
Now for the EFD Group, Mr. Farage.
Well, I must congratulate you, Mr. Samaras, for getting the Greek presidency off to such a cracking start. Your overnight successful negotiation in the trialogue on MIFID, I'm sure, will have them dancing in the streets of Athens. No matter that your country, very poorly advised by Goldman Sachs, joined a currency that it was never suited to, no matter that 30% are unemployed, that 60% of youth are unemployed, that a neo-Nazi party is on the march, that there was a terrorist attack on the German embassy. No, don't worry about all that, because the trialogue on MIFID has been a success. And in many ways, it sums up the two Europes. The Europe that's talked about in here by the Dreamers, who want to impose a new United States of Europe with an identity and a currency, and the real world out there. And you come here, Mr. Samaras, and you tell us that you represent the sovereign will of the Greek people. Well, I'm sorry, but you're not in charge of Greece. And I suggest you rename and rebrand your party. It's called New Democracy. I suggest you call it No Democracy. Because Greece is now under foreign control. You can't make any decisions. You've been bailed out and you've surrendered. Democracy, the thing your country invented in the first place. And you can't admit that joining the euro was a mistake, because, of course, Mr. Papandreou did that, didn't he? He even said there should be a referendum in Greece. And within 48 hours, the unholy trinity that now run this European Union had him removed and replaced by an ex-Goldman Sachs employee puppet. We are run now by big business, big banks, and in the shape of Mr. Barroso, big bureaucrats. And actually, that's what these European elections are really going to be all about. It's going to be a battle of national democracy versus EU state bureaucracy. Whatever you may say in this chamber, the people out there don't want a United States of Europe. They want a Europe of sovereign states trading and working together. And I believe the European elections are going to mark a watershed. Up until now, everybody has thought, much as they may not like the development of the European Union, that it was inevitable. That myth of inevitability will be shattered by the European elections this year. Thank you.
That's Nigel Farage from the UK Independence Party there, speaking earlier this week in the European Parliament, really condemning what he calls the United States of Europe. Now, Daniela, if there's going to be a protest vote against the EU, it certainly is not going to be going to the Greens. Surely most people will be voting for UKIP. And do you think the Greens and the UKIP, what's the distinction between the two positions? Because I know both are broadly anti-EU.
Yeah, I mean, we believe that power should be devolved to the lowest possible area, but we recognise that there have been some good developments come out of Europe and that it's a reasonable institution, but we in some ways agree that we don't like the way it's going into a huge federated being of an international state, because that doesn't really work.
Well, it's totally the opposite, isn't it, really, of what you're saying. If you're talking about local, devolving stuff locally, EU is doing completely the opposite.
Yeah.
But what about
we like local currencies, you know, we don't want the euro, we want even smaller currencies in the pound, so we want everything going in the opposite direction. But the EU has brought some good benefits to us, and we can move around Europe, we can work everywhere, so I think there are some benefits as well. And some of the environmental legislation coming from Europe has been a good thing for this country.
What about migration? Because we've seen in all these extra passes allowed for Bulgarians and Romanians now to come to Britain to take jobs. Well, we haven't even got enough jobs for our young people. We've got 1.2 million between 16 and 25 unemployed, and yet we're saying come in to migrants to take those jobs.
Well, I think it's an open jobs market and people can go off where they like and look for jobs. And people won't necessarily travel unless they've got a job to come to. They might come, look around, not find a job and go away. I don't think setting people against each other in terms of saying we're all in competition isn't the right way
to
do it.
But that's a jobs market. People are against each other.
Well, to a certain extent, but it's not as doesn't have to be as competitive as that. You know, there's jobs that everyone can have if they want them.
I mean, surely we should only be asking people to come to Britain, inviting people to come to Britain, if we have enough jobs to go round. If we don't, then what we're doing is we're saying we're consigning millions of people, maybe around about 2.5-3 million now, forever to the dole. I mean, it's already very well to blame people for being unemployed, but when we clearly know there aren't enough jobs for everybody.
Well, I think we need to think about how we create jobs, and we need to think very differently about the economy. And why do we all have to work 37, 40, 50 hours a week? Actually, we need to think about how people's time is used and how people can work differently and spend more time caring for people. So I'd have actually quite a different view of how we should be organising our working patterns.
Okay, well, that's all. We've got the Murdoch News at 6 coming up now. Thanks to this week's guest, Green Councillor for Bishopston, Daniela Radici. After the news, a massive dossier from public interest lawyers about British war crimes.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, police say they've been unable to confirm any sightings of a missing 3-year-old boy from Edinburgh. Mikhail Kular's mother last saw him on Wednesday night. A possible sighting around a mile away from his home yesterday morning is still being investigated. Assistant Chief Constable Malcolm Graham says it's impossible to say whether he left the house by himself.
It is, however, entirely possible that Mikhail has become subject of a criminal act. That eventuality is being and will be fully explored.
Ed Miliband says Labour